In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about Iran and recent events there. Earlier this summer, in June, voters in Iran went to the polls to choose a new president to succeed Mohammad Khatami. He has been president since 1997. Now, in the run-up to that first round of voting that took place on June 17th, the front runner seemed to be a former president of the country, Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani. He was the president from 1989 until 1997. In the first round, however, none of the candidates in the running got the required 50% that was needed to win, so there was a runoff between the top two, being Mr. Rafsanjani, and to everybody's surprise, the mayor of Tehran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And the result of that runoff that took place on June 24th was what has been described as a landslide victory for Mr. Ahmadinejad, leaving many people to wonder just what that really means for the future of Iran, for its relations with the rest of the world, and particularly for this difficult relationship now, for going back some years, between Iran and the United States. We'll try and take up some of these questions in this part of the show as we talk with Ahmad Sadri. He's professor of sociology and anthropology at Lake Forest College, which is in Lake Forest, Illinois. His special area of interest and research, the politics of Iran and the Middle East. He's been with us before on the program to talk about Iran. And in fact, he was there on sabbatical during the time that the polling took place. So we're pleased that he could give us some of his time this morning. Questions are welcome, as always. Callers would like to call in. The only thing we ask of people is that people are just brief so that we could keep the program moving. But anyone who is interested in calling in certainly can do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you can certainly give us a call. Professor Sadri, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us again.
It's a pleasure to be with you again.
We certainly appreciate it. A number of questions that I'd like to ask, and going back to the elections, when you read the stories about the outcome and people talk about the winner, the stories all seem to say something to the effect that it was certainly very unexpected, and his second place showing in the first round of voting, that he came out of nowhere. So perhaps one place we can start is to talk a little bit about why it seems that people who were observing this election, both outside and it seems that even inside Iran, failed to predict this strong showing by Mr. Ahmadinejad.
Well, I should probably start by telling a story of my own surprise as this started to unravel. A day before the election, there was a straw poll in one of the lectures at the University of Tehran, and I was shocked to see Ahmadinejad coming first, and I definitely thought this has got to be a mistake. Later on, I heard, after the victory of Ahmadinejad, I heard the head of a major polling institution that helped the reformers in their efforts say exactly the same thing, that he kept seeing these numbers coming up, and he basically discounted the evidence of his own eyes, and he said either there is some kind of a flagrant cheating, or this has got to be some kind of an accident. So, in a way, there was nobody who was not surprised. Of course, pundits would like to speak as if they nearly told you so after the fact. But indeed, nobody expected this, and Ahmadinejad's victory was a big surprise. And I should add that surprises are in these kinds of elections are good. You don't want elections that are entirely predictable. And Ahmadinejad's victory, although very disheartening to reformers like myself, was, and despite the irregularities in the election, was a landslide victory.
It appears that the key to this win was the focus by Mr. Ahmadinejad on domestic issues. And a lot of his support came from people who were poor and disadvantaged. And that was very important. And one wonders whether, in fact, the failure by the pundits and the people who were doing the polls and the surveying to predict this win had something to do with who it is they chose to talk to as they were doing their sampling and their surveys. And perhaps they didn't talk to enough of the right people to get an idea of how broad a base of support there was for Mr. Ahmadinejad.
I would tend to both agree and disagree with that statement. Of course, there were major flaws in the polling apparatus in Iran, and that consisted of not having enough polling stations in the villages. And so most of the polling stations, most of the populations polled were in the major cities that had always determined the outcome. And they didn't have enough people in the villages to poll, number one. And number two, again, as I said, the polls did predict Mr. Ahmadinejad's victory. It's like the people who were at the helm, they didn't want to believe what they were seeing. So that is one thing. On the other hand, I disagree with the basic argument that this was the, so to speak, economy is stupid, that determined what happened. I think Ahmadinejad won on a symbolic campaign. Of course, part of his campaign was to pass himself off as a populist, to flaunt his modest home, and to regale himself in his earthy manners. But these are all symbolic, and indeed the results show that in the most deprived states in Iran, ethnicity was a much better determinant of the result than economics. So my basic reading is that Ahmadinejad won a symbolic victory, and it had very little to do with economics.
How much of this had to do with people's disenchantment with government, feeling that it was either incompetent or corrupt or both, and that he could, as sometimes American politicians do, represent himself as an outsider? Interestingly enough, though, because it seemed to he was the choice of the ruling clerics, that he could make this argument that he wasn't what here in the United States we would call a professional politician with all the baggage that comes with that, and that he could be a guy that could make the difference, could clean things up, and in a sense could change, again, to adopt that phrase we hear so much in American politics, he would change the style of government as usual.
I could not agree more with what you just said. He really did pull George W. in Iran. That's what he did. The ultimate insider, cruising on the money gotten from the right-wing sources, such as the Revolutionary Guards with their amazing resources, with their Halliburton-like no-bid contracts in Iran, with their huge public works, with their hidden piers at the Persian Gulf used to import contraband. He took all his money and he ran a perfectly good campaign, but at the same time, part of his campaign was the ultimate insider pretending and successfully passing himself off to be the ultimate outsider. He played that game. We have got to hand it to him impeccably.
In that first round of voting there afterwards, when Mr. Ahmadinejad ended up coming in second to Mr. Rafsanjani, polling fairly closely, Mr. Rafsanjani got 6.2 million votes, and Mr. Ahmadinejad got 5.7, and then the other candidates, the next three, were sort of bunched together. After that first result, there were people who were charging that there had been some sort of fraud. Has anybody seriously looked into that, or does anybody seriously think that, in fact, there was anything wrong with the first round, the June 17th round of voting?
There were plenty wrong with it, but I would not call it a fraudulent result. Indeed, there were irregularities. Mainly, these irregularities occur in the beginning of the Iranian revolution, Iranian elections, and at the end. At the beginning, they come through the vetting powers of the Guardian Council that basically, based on a right-wing bias, chooses the candidates. And at the end, of course, the same Guardian Council has the right to adjudicate which parts of which polling stations show irregularities. And so they have used their powers in order to manipulate elections in that way. Another major irregularity is the participation of the semi-official military corps, or the Basij, which basically means mobilization. These corps were formed during the Iran-Iraq War by irregulars, but now they have been maintained, and they were used for the first time very effectively to support the candidate that was favored by the supreme leader. Now we should note that the supreme leader of Iran did not initially back Ahmadinejad. He was backing another candidate whose campaign was basically kind of like, if you saw his pictures, he was a leader of the Revolutionary Guards and a pilot. It was like a GQ commercial. He was trying to pass himself off as the favorite of the young generation and the secular groups, although he was a right winger. That didn't pan out. And a few days before the election, the supreme leader switched to Ahmadinejad. That meant that these irregular forces, the Basij, actually brought in the voters from their family, from their friends, and they did an excellent job of getting out the vote. So, of course, the loser in that first round, Mr. Karrubi, who was almost a shoo-in for going to the second round, he lost by a very slim margin. And he, of course, is not like the former president Khatami, a kind of a mild-mannered guy. He's kind of shrewish. And he started to complain that the Basij should not have intervened. And he is right, the Basij should not have intervened. But at the same time, there were irregularities, but there was no ballot box stuffing, as the numbers show. There is sophisticated analysis of the numbers in various areas, and none of them show any kind of a flagrant irregularities. So, yes, there were... The Iranian elections are like the socks that you buy on sale. They are kind of irregular, but they are not fraudulent. They are not like Saddam Hussein or North Korean or Soviet elections that everything is decided ahead of time.
Yeah. If you take a look at the vote totals that the various candidates, the top vote getters got in the first round on June 17th, I find myself wondering, well, if a majority of those people who had voted for the other candidates, excluding Mr. Ahmadinejad, had decided that they wanted to throw their support between to Mr. Khatami, thinking that if you're inclined towards reform, you're certainly not going to vote for Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. It would seem to me that if those people had rallied around the most reform-minded candidate, that should have been enough. I mean, even I would think even if all of the people who voted for Mr. Karrubi had decided to vote for Mr. Rafsanjani, that would have been significant. I mean, what happened in the second round?
Well, it is funny that we have been talking about elections for a few minutes now. We haven't mentioned the main reform candidate, Mr. Moin, who came in like number six or number five, I think. I think it is number five or six. I really don't care to think about him much anymore, although all the reformers apparently wanted to vote for him. He lost so miserably. Because, to go back to something that you pointed out in your first question, because of the, number one, massive disenchantment of Iranians with 8 years of Mr. Khatami's incompetent and inept leadership, but also with the reformers thinking that people are going to vote for them no matter what. This is a... This is kind of like what Woody Allen in one of his movies accused one of the protagonists. He said that you are not paranoid. You are the opposite of a paranoid. You walk around thinking that everybody loves you. The reformers in Iran really suffered from this syndrome. They thought that people are going to come out and vote for them. And I was at the headquarters of the reform at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when it was pretty clear that Moin, the Iranian, the reform candidate, is not going to win. And they were still betting their life savings that Moin is going to win, and he's going to win a landslide in the first round. So they were pretty deluded, the right wing. The reformers. Now, once we got to the second round, we had 1 week, and Moin was nowhere to be seen. Karoubi was that was the only moderately left-leaning candidate was defeated. It was time for the reformers to rally behind Rafsanjani. And I should say, in the interest of transparency, that I wrote an article in the main daily in Iran, Sharq, urging all the reformers to vote against Ahmadinejad, not necessarily for Rafsanjani, but basically to vote for the lesser of the two evils. Of course, we all were surprised that this kind of rallying behind Rafsanjani never occurred. And to make a long story short, I think the main reason is that Rafsanjani was too tainted with the goings-on, the economic corruption and political shenanigans and serial murders, politically motivated murders, to be able to carry the reform banner. And other symbolic issues intervened, and of course, among all of these, Ahmadinejad's amazing, savvy appearances on TV in his debates, in my view, played a major role in getting a big chunk of the undecided vote to show the landslide that he did in the second round.
Let me just very quickly introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're talking with Ahmad Sadri. He's professor of sociology and anthropology at Lake Forest College in Lake Forest, Illinois, and is interested in Iran and the Middle East, also the politics of Iran and reform in Iran and in Islam. He was in Iran at the time of the elections we're talking about. That was earlier this summer, in June. And we're talking a bit about Iranian politics, and we'll continue to talk about that, and also about relations between Iran and the United States. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Clearly, one thing we should remind people is that the president of Iran, whoever that person is not the most powerful person in the country. In fact, the most powerful person in the country, the supreme leader, is at this point a man named Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who has that position and will have that position as long as he is alive, has been since 1989. He gets to pick the head of the country's judiciary. He also selects the Guardian Council, and these are the people that we have seen in news stories have intervened in the election process by saying who can and cannot run. He is an extraordinarily powerful man. Given that, one wonders, does it matter very much who the president of Iran is?
Yes, all of the every single fact that you mentioned about the powers of Mr. Khamenei is correct. He has enormous powers, and I would say that about 60% of power in Iran accrues to the office of the supreme leader, who is an unelected power, and it is basically the theocratic structure riding on the democratic infrastructure that exists in Iran. So, yeah, we can say that people are vying for that 40% or 50% of power that is elective in Iran, and that comprises the presidency and the parliament. But in Iran, it seems that people like to exercise whatever democratic power that they have, and we can tell this from the numbers. In the nine elections, presidential elections that we have had in Iran, the participation has never fallen below 50%. And the It has gone up all the way to 79%. So it looks like that the people are cleaving to the little sliver of power that elective powers have in Iran, and they are not willing to give that up or participate in a large boycott of the elections. That was called by a lot of opposition leaders living in exile. And it looks like that all that they got, probably the people who actually didn't go out to vote on political grounds, the ones who boycotted it, could not have been more than 6 or 7%. So, yes, it is kind of depressingly unimportant, these elective powers, but Iranian people seem to still be unable to part with this partial say that they have in the running of their affairs.
Mm. We talked earlier about the fact that people in Iran who had previously voted for reform were extremely disenchanted with the inability of particularly of President Khatami, who was elected as a reformer in 1997, his inability to fulfill his pledges and to accomplish much of anything. But given, though, the fact that the clerics have so much power and so much power is concentrated in the hands of Mr. Khamenei, and the fact, just for example, that in the past couple of elections, the Guardian Councils has literally thrown thousands of people off the ballot. Reformers who would have run were disqualified. I think one of the things I read was in a recent round of elections there, they tossed 1,000 reform candidates off the ballot, and all of the women. None of the women who said that they wanted to run were allowed to run. I mean, given that reformers have to deal with that kind of opposition from conservative clerics, then how much fault do you assign to reform generally and Mr. Khatami in particular when you say they failed to achieve anything?
First, I have to correct an impression that exists and it has been repeated by President Bush also. It is the powers, the vetting powers of the Guardian Council are unjust and undemocratic. But also there is a flaw in the way in which the candidates are chosen in Iranian elections. We don't have primaries. So therefore, at the beginning, there's a call for people who are interested in becoming president. And you have people from an 18-year-old illiterate guy to a retired bus driver applying to be president. So, of course, a lot of these people, not all of these 1,000 people that are mentioned, are reformers. Mm. And there are some pretty right-wing, very religious people, including a former member of the Guardian Council who was disqualified. So the disqualifications by the Guardian Council are partial, but this number 1,000 is kind of misleading. Now to the other part of your question, can we really say that Mr. Khatami has been derelict in his duties, given the fact that he really didn't have much power to begin with? Yeah. I would say yes, in a way he's derelict in his duties, because his duties was not only to act within the constitution of Iran, he was also the leader of the reform movement with high hopes for changing the system, not only playing with the rules in the system. And not only he played with the rules, he went out of his way to be pleasing to the powers that be, rather than trying to implement some change, because the reform movement in Iran was not about participating in politics as usual. It was about changing the unjust powers of theocracy in Iran and going towards reforming Iran into a democracy. Mr. Khatami didn't even come close to representing the enormous powers and the aspirations of the reform movement in Iran. So as a regular president, no, probably he's not derelict in his duties, but as a leader of the reform movement, and as someone that people invested all of their hopes and aspirations for Iran in him, he's a miserable failure.
Mm. Well, let's talk about Mr. Ahmadinejad, because he, as we discussed, certainly in some of the coverage that we would have seen in the mainstream Western press, would not have been identified as being a likely winner. And everyone talked about what a surprise win this was. And then immediately there had to be a lot of stories basically answering the question, who is this man? So why don't I give you an opportunity just to talk a little bit about him, who he is, his background, and then we can go on to look at what he has said about policy and what he might like to see happen.
Well, I would say that he's about my age. He is a true son of this revolution, and he was an undergraduate in one of the technical universities, one of the elite technical colleges in Tehran when revolution occurred. And he joined the revolution enthusiastically, and he has remained remarkably consistent in his dedication to the revolutionary ideal. So when after the Iran-Iraq war, after that huge disappointment, a lot of the reformers separated from the core and formed a counter-movement, Ahmadinejad was proud to remain consistent. And when Khatami won, when he went to his classes, now as a professor in the same university, he wore the shawl that is identified with the right-wing militias, indicating that he's not at all affected by this. So he's an ideologically dedicated man to the cause of the regular revolutionary politics, and he has a very technical mind. He's very hardworking, but he has no talent for appreciating ambiguity or cultural relativism. He's a purist. He's a straightforward religious man, and he's ultimately a technocrat.
Among the things that I had read about him was a comment going to the issue of his conservatism. The comment was something to the effect of, well, whatever he may be, he's not a cleric. Is that, in fact, a significant kind of point to make in talking about who he is?
Yes and no, again, because some people kind of go only with the garb, with the appearance. So, yeah, he is not wearing a cleric's garb. He's actually an engineer. He's a professor of engineering. He has always been an excellent student throughout his studies. From the first grade, he has been in the top, I would say, 1% of his peers. He's not a cleric, but he is in a lot of ways worse than a cleric if you take Mr. Khatami to be a cleric. You have clerics who are reformers, and you have non-clerics who are hardened right-wingers. So, yes, he's not wearing a clerical garb, but his dedication to Mr. Khamenei, the supreme leader, and the clerical establishment, I would say I would much rather have a cleric in power who is a reformer rather than a lay person who is so enamored of clerics.
Immediately after he was elected, there were some people that were raising questions about his role, or whether or not he had a role in the seizure of the U.S. embassy in Tehran in 1979 that led to the long hostage crisis. Apparently, some of the people who had been held hostage saw him and said, well, we think that he looks familiar, that he might have been one of the hostage takers. And also, at the same time, people in Iran who admitted that they were involved in this said, no, he was not. He might have been a very politically active student at the time when he was at university, but he was not directly involved. And after a while, those stories seemed to sort of die down. Was it established without any doubt that he, in fact, didn't indirectly was not involved in this, in the hostage taking?
In my mind, there is absolutely no doubt that he was not among the hostage takers. We know who the hostage takers are. And in a way, I wish he were a hostage taker, because all of those hostage takers, to a person almost, later on joined the reform movement. Almost they are to the last person, if they are not dead, if they were not killed in the Iran-Iraq war, and many of them were, they all joined the reformers, and they all admit that hostage taking was a huge mistake. Ahmadinejad was not among the hostage takers. Actually, at the time that they were contemplating taking the American hostages, these students of two other universities, both of them, again, engineering schools, Ahmadinejad argued for taking the Russian embassy rather than the American embassy. So he was not in the core of the students who took hostages. And the person who appears next to a blindfolded hostage is not Ahmadinejad. He's another man who had a tragic fate himself. He was the Iranian counsel to Afghanistan, and then he was suspected of participating in some terrorist activities against the Islamic government, brought to Iran, and he died under very suspicious circumstances in prison, probably under torture. So the person that's suspected to be Ahmadinejad is not Ahmadinejad, but I should add that when these stories appear and the impression is created in the mass media, the denial stories that was not a true story appear much later, and the impression remains that Ahmadinejad was a hostage taker. Mm.
Let's talk about policy, I guess we can look broadly at the two areas, both in terms of domestic policy and in terms of foreign policy. Domestic policy first. We were talking earlier about the fact that that Mr. Ahmadinejad assumed this kind of populist mantle, styled himself as man of the people. And certainly it is true that rate of poverty and unemployment is high in Iran. The economy certainly could be better, and there are apparently a lot of people who are concerned about their basic, meeting their basic needs day to day. What sort of things has he said, or do you think he'd be likely to do in terms of policy at home that would be significant, and it might in fact be a significant departure from what previous governments have done?
Well, the answer is not much. He has campaigned on a populist platform, basically mostly symbolic stuff like, oh, look at my house, I don't have a swimming pool. And that says a lot to Iranians, because a lot of these Islamic officials have very luxurious abodes. And he did practice a sort of populist redistribution system when he was the mayor of Tehran, giving generous bonuses to teachers, which was, of course, as the mayor, none of his business, giving gold coins to the kiosk operators in Tehran, again, none of his concern, giving handouts and bonuses to people. And this is the kind of style that you can buy a lot of publicity for, but you can't run an economy like that. This would be, even with the huge petrodollars that are coming his way, and he's extremely lucky right now to be the president at this time, you can't just distribute that kind of wealth. So his economics remain still a mystery, and we have to wait and see what happens. He said a lot of things, and his economic advisor said a lot of things that were extremely scary in terms of centralizing economy and controlling the prices and kind of going back to some of the socialist policies of the first decade of the revolution. But they have taken some of those back. It really remains to be seen how he is going to decrease unemployment, for instance, which is a huge problem in Iran. And he is in for a huge disappointment by all these people who voted for him. I think now he has to deliver on those almost undeliverable promises that he has made.
Well, I'm interested. You actually use the word socialism because in some of the stories that I have read, they have used the phrase "is Islamic socialism" to describe his sort of domestic agenda. So you would think that that would actually be an appropriate kind of language to use?
Yeah, I mean, again, he has used it in terms of its symbolic value. Nothing in detail. What he has basically talked about, he has talked about rich people or unfair advantages or people who have offices but they don't care about people. He believes that all managers should be men of people. I wrote an article after his victory entitled "The Banana Free Republic of Mr. Ahmadinejad." And the title came from the fact that he had banned eating bananas. I must add that bananas are a luxury fruit, kind of expensive in Iran. And the managers of the Tehran municipality would apparently drink fruit juices and banana on their breaks. And he said, this is not a seemly behavior. People are starving. Why are you eating bananas? So basically, symbolic socialism, but implementing some of those socialist policies would be disastrous for Iran. It will create huge problems, and I don't think the technocrats that are running the Iranian economy would be willing to go that route. And I just can't see a huge socialist turnaround, throwback to the days, the first decade of revolution under another prime minister, Mr. Mousavi. And so it is very doubtful what will happen, what he will do with these petrodollars. It remains to be seen. Mm-hmm. But again, it is my guess that in a year's time, there will be a huge disappointment when people who voted for him don't see the results in their pocketbooks.
And as far as foreign policy goes, much has been made of the fact that at least in his previous positions, it wouldn't have been part of his brief to have to be concerned about foreign policy. The things he's said so far seem to be fairly strongly nationalistic, talking about the right of Iran to choose its own course, and that other nations should certainly understand that. And as far as the relationship with the United States goes, he seemed to be saying something to the effect of, you know, we don't particularly need the United States, and maybe we're not all that concerned with what they think. Is it likely that with him as president that Iran's foreign policy would change particularly, that we would see anything radically significant or significantly different than what we've seen before?
I don't think there's going to be anything radically different. Again, Mr. Ahmadinejad is probably one of the luckiest people on the face of this earth because his coming to power has coincided with the spectacular American weakness in the area. Americans seem to have exhausted themselves in Afghanistan and spread themselves pretty thin in Iraq. So their bark apparently does not have the same effect, because it is pretty obvious that Americans are not able to mount anything significant against Iran. So Ahmadinejad can't talk big right now because the possibility of Americans, the American threat appears to be hollow at this point. That is one thing. The other thing is that Ahmadinejad is also lucky because the entire nuclear issue brought up against Iran seems to be falling apart. The predictions that Iran is going to produce an atomic weapon in 2 years now are extended to 10 years. And the issue of nuclear power in Iran has turned into a nationalistic cause. And I should say that this makes perfect sense because what the European Union and the Americans seem to be wishing to impose on Iran appears to be against the sovereign wishes of Iran and Iran's legal rights under non-proliferation treaty. So Ahmadinejad also rode the crest of that wave. And at this point, he seems to be able to hold the line. Again, he has not really said anything inflammatory against Americans. He has pointed out in an oblique way to Europeans and Americans as meddlers and as people who are willing to humiliate Iran. And this has a great echo for the nationalist aspirations of Iranians. And so there is not much to be done. Basically, most of what Iran wanted to do in the area has been accomplished by Americans. Iranians had two enemies, the Taliban to the east and Saddam Hussein to the west, and Americans have successfully taken both of those out. Iranians attempted but failed in both cases, and Americans have done them a great service. And the government in Iraq is entirely friendly to Iranians. So there is not much that Iran really needs to do except hold the line on the negotiations about atomic power, and that doesn't seem to require a huge shift.
We have about 10 minutes perhaps left in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Ahmad Sadri. He's professor of sociology and anthropology at Lake Forest College in Lake Forest, Illinois. He is a specialist in the politics of Iran and the Middle East. He was in Iran and had an opportunity to observe firsthand the elections that took place in June. And we're talking about what has been happening there lately. Questions welcome. We have a caller ready to go. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Callers in Champaign County, line 1. Hello.
Hi. This is one way of balancing the geopolitics of the area, but the U.S. was never planning on a land-based attack. It hasn't used any cruise missiles in Iraq for quite a while, in Iran either. They're being replenished, and I don't think that we should be as cavalier about the possibility of the Bush administration doing something like this. Now, they're having a lot of trouble making anything sound reasonable. Their response to this revelation that the story the Iranians were telling, that the particular enriched uranium that was on some machinery in one of the plants was actually a product of our ally Pakistan, and their sloppy handling of the machinery in advance, it wasn't related to anything the Iranians had done. That's been pretty established. The U.S. announces that it doesn't change their assessment, which you know, they were relying on it. They've been pretty ham-handed about it, it seems, but I wouldn't be as cavalier, I don't think, and I don't think the people in Tehran should be as cavalier about the idea that the U.S. could mount a week-long cruise missile attack at supposed industrial and targets. I mean, it looks a little far-fetched now with the popularity that Bush has right now, but he doesn't have a whole lot to lose in one sense, so I hope you're right, but I wouldn't put aside the worry.
Well, Professor Sadri, what do you think?
Well, I think the caller is absolutely right, and I hope I didn't sound cavalier about the possibilities of an air attack and a cruise missile attack. And actually, I made this argument in my article that I wrote against voting for Ahmadinejad, because it appeared that if Ahmadinejad is elected, this will provide part of the puzzle that the American neoconservatives need to put in place before they can convince the American people that Iranians can be controlled by this kind of air attack. So it is entirely possible that Americans would do something like that, but also it is possible not because it makes rational sense, but partly because I think the new conservative administration in Washington is animated much more by ideology than by a rational calculation of American interests. And I believe, and this is my personal opinion, that the invasion of Iraq was exactly the result of that kind of ideological thinking rather than a rational calculation of benefits of oil or geopolitical situations. So, yes, it is entirely possible that such an attack could be mounted. And incidentally, if such an attack is mounted, I would say that one of the people who would be happiest about it is the Supreme Leader and the right-wing administration in Iran, because such an attack would be very, very difficult to mount. It would impose a huge collateral damage, and they can use that to effectively declare martial law and roll back all reform and ensure that they enjoy the popularity of a government that is defending Iranians against a foreign invasion. After all, they have been saying that Americans want to get us for 20 years when Americans were not out to get Iranians. Now, if something like that happens, it looks like that it would be a dream come true. And I should also add that one of the reasons that Ahmadinejad won in the first round was President Bush's very ill-timed lecture about how elections in Iran are fake. That talk was played without any commentary on Iranian television, almost nonstop during the election day. And I would say, and a lot of people would agree with me, that it brought another 5% right-wingers to the polls, and that may have been the reason why the Karrubi candidacy failed. I think the right-wingers, neoconservatives in the United States have helped Ahmadinejad once, and if there is an air attack against Iran, that would be another bonus for Ahmadinejad.
I have a question that's kind of hard to formulate, particularly in a few minutes, about the internal dynamics. We have our own fundamentalists here, and they are talking about assassinating people and talking about Ishmael, apparently, last night in very caricaturish terms. So, but it seems to me that this divide between a kind of liberalized youth culture with some abuses, the fact that heroin is now cheap from Afghanistan, I think is contributing to, in other words, I'm trying to get at, I don't share the assessment of the decadence of the West particularly, but it's also a convenient thing for the mullahs to use at this point, it seems, and there is this kind of divide. I don't think it was primary in the election, but I think it's a factor that shouldn't be dismissed in some ways. I do think that the economic argument and the argument that he's going to stop corruption, though, since he's tied in with the Republican Guard, and you were saying that they are the ones that really get the Halliburton-style contracts, as it were, that he's not going to be able to actually come through with that. If he was sincere to begin with. Do you have a reaction to any of that?
Oh, well, I think the caller really touched a lot of various bases, and I wish we had another hour to talk about all of these. We do have a huge problem with youth culture. We have a huge, huge problem with heroin. The caller is absolutely right. Heroin is extremely cheap in Iran, and this has the price has been going down after the American victory there, and Iran is waging a real battle against these narcotics. It's a losing battle because those narco warlords are so powerful that the Medellin cartel would pale in significance. So Iran has a problem with this, and Ahmadinejad did have a great deal to say about the youth culture, about decadence and things like that. And indeed, he would use exactly those arguments. He would say, look, our youth are going astray, and there, something should be done, and we should revive the purity of Islamic culture. And it did have a resonance. So in a way, yes, he did play on this issue. But he basically would argue that the decadence that you see among Iranian youth is a result of a distance that has been created between revolutionary ideals and the aspirations of the youth, and that's something that he promised to remedy.
So very briefly here, unfortunately, we are at the time we have to finish here. Whither reform now in Iran, I guess, would be the question. You know, what is the possibility for those people who are interested in reform?
Well, I wish I knew. The reformers are kind of shell-shocked at this point. The political reform seems to be pretty dead in the water right now. And they are really assessing, trying to see where they are going to go from here. Some are planning to take advantage of the inevitable disenchantment that is going to come in the wake of Ahmadinejad's inability to deliver on his promises. But they have not really come to any kind of a conclusion. The good news is that the intellectual reform continues strong. Reform intellectuals in Iran are still formulating their ideas, and sooner or later they think that the Iranians will wake from this theocratic nightmare and implement a more mainstream political system in Iran. But I would say that the reformers really have not really decided on what course to pick at this point. I know for a fact that they are thinking very hard about it. They had several meetings after the defeat, inviting intellectuals to come and talk about what happened and criticize them. But I'm not aware that there is any unified ideology picked as of this moment. Mm.
Well, there we will leave it. Our guest this morning, Ahmad Zadri, is professor of sociology and anthropology at Lake Forest College in Lake Forest, Illinois. Professor Zadri, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.